Welcome to the program for Wednesday, December 19th, 2012, on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM every Wednesday in the 3 o'clock hour. It is Pentagon Solutions, where we talk about the challenges the Pentagon is dealing with, and we hear from people both inside and outside the building on how to deal with those challenges, look for potential solutions to those challenges. My guest today knows some of those challenges quite intimately. He is William Lynn, the former Deputy Secretary of Defense and now the Chief Executive Officer of DRS Technologies. Mr. Secretary, it's great to see you. I'm sorry I'm still in the habit of calling you and your peers. Mr. Secretary, it's a pleasure to have you in the studio with me today.
Great to be here, Francis.
We're going to talk about cybersecurity pretty extensively today because this is an issue that you were quite out in front on when you were at DOD, and it's a challenge that is not going away anytime soon for the agency. What is your assessment from where you sit today as a leader in industry now and a former leader at the Pentagon of the Defense Department's cyber posture?
Well, I think the Defense Department has improved its cyber posture over the last few years. We had an incident back in 2008 we called Buckshot Yankee. It was a serious intrusion into some of our most classified networks, networks, frankly, that we thought were invulnerable to intrusion. So we were caught short, and we've since then tried to respond and put defense in depth in place to be able to respond to the kinds of threats that we see, and those threats are increasing. We've also made a number of organizational shifts, most prominently the institution of a cyber command, a full-fledged military command to deal with this new domain. So I think all of those steps have improved the department's posture in terms of cyber defense. It's not perfect. It's never going to be perfect, but it's better.
Buckshot Yankee was kind of a watershed moment, too, because there are a lot of observers that believe that in the past the Pentagon would not have even revealed such an episode, that for fear of vulnerability and so forth. You were the point man for the response to Buckshot Yankee and talked about it pretty extensively. Talk about that mindset, that worldview, that this is a problem that we're having and it's something that we need to talk about rather than something that we shouldn't talk about.
Well, the things that you shouldn't talk about are things where we might compromise our advantages or compromise certainly the safety of our troops. So those things you don't want to compromise. Buckshot Yankee was a wake-up call. Buckshot Yankee was an indication that our cyber defenses weren't what they should be. And it caused us to make changes, and it made it easier to make those changes and getting support from Congress and the public if we explained why we were doing what we were doing.
And as that response rolled out, what did you learn throughout that process, both personally and as an agency, about where we were and what we had to do in order to prevent another Buckshot Yankee from happening again?
Well, I think the biggest thing you learn is there is no perfect defense. In the cyber domain, the attacker has all of the advantages. In the cyber world, we have to be perfect every time to hold the attacker out. The attacker only has to succeed once to get in. So you have to operate in a world that you have to assume the attacker is going to succeed on occasion. So we have to have a layered defense. We have to be able to hunt on our own networks to find those who do get through. And we need to be able to operate in degraded environments. So we needed, I think, a more nuanced approach to our cyber posture.
What will and obviously there's limits to what you can talk about, but what do you think that nuance will look like? How will that appear especially from the intruder's point of view? What's the intruder going to find that maybe he didn't find before?
Well, hopefully he's not going to be able to get through as often as he did. When he gets through, he's not going to be able to find the information as easily as he did. He's going to find that things are more segmented than they were. So getting through in one area doesn't mean you have access to all areas. And he's going to find even when he gets through, we're still chasing him, and we're going to chase him down, and we're going to take him out of the network.
Was that concept that there is no perfect defense hard for the agency to adjust to? It strikes me that the Pentagon prefers things to be absolutes, either something is or isn't, and the idea that we're never going to get this completely 100% guaranteed lockdown can be a little bit difficult.
I don't think that's difficult for the military, and the military operates in a world, the old saying, that no plan survives first contact with the enemy. Things change. You have to be You have to be able to adjust. You have to be able to adapt to the environment. You have to assume that the enemy has a vote.
How is the threat landscape different today than it was when you first went back to DOD in 09?
Well, I think the threat is developing along two dimensions. What you're seeing is that the types of threats are becoming increasingly destructive. We started with a world where most of the threats were actually really theft, stealing of information, stealing of data. We've moved up now to you see disruption, denial of service attacks, and you're just at the cusp of seeing truly destructive attacks where you can use a cyber means to actually destroy a piece of infrastructure, a piece of hardware. So we're evolving up a ladder of escalation, and I don't think we've reached the top of that ladder. At the same time, we used to have a world where the most sophisticated cyber capabilities were held by major nation states. Now you're increasingly seeing rogue states trying to acquire those same capabilities, and I think eventually you'll see terrorist groups, and you actually already see criminal groups acquiring those capabilities. And cyber is such that it doesn't require a major industrial capacity to have very significant capability. So I think what the nation needs to be ready for is a marriage of those two trends. As the threats get more and more destructive, and as the actors get more and more malicious out to terrorist groups, when terrorist groups have truly destructive threats, that's, I think, the threat we need to worry about.
And that then, my list then says that there are four organizations that we should be thinking about defending against: the major nation states, the rogue nation states, organized crime, and terrorist organizations. Each one of those, I imagine, projects its threats in a different way or for different purposes. Is that fair to say?
Oh, that's absolutely fair to say. And another difference is you have very different abilities to deter those groups. Major nation states have very much to lose by confronting the United States in cyber or any other domain. A terrorist group, on the other hand, has very little to lose. So that as you think about how do you parry and counter these thrusts, the deterrent model, which applies in many aspects of our relations with nation states, as cyber as well as others, doesn't apply very well in the terrorist domain. And so there we need to adapt our responses accordingly.
As we go through that adaption process, are the nature of these threats such that we can expect those to evolve as well, and so our responses will continue to evolve? Or is it your view that these threats will harden and the techniques and the reasons behind them and the potential responses will harden too?
At this point, it's remained very, very fluid. The only constant, as I said, is the attacker has more advantages than the defender. I think over time, that's something we're going to want to change. It'll take years, but I think we should be investing in research that will improve the security of the Internet overall. I think that will be good for all users of the Internet, both security-related as well as non-security.
I want to go back to Buckshot Yankee for just a moment, because as I covered you first talking about that the very first day that you mentioned it, it occurred to me that the weak link was the poor person that actually put the thumb drive in the computer. And that's something that all the sophisticated technology and preparation and training can't really do anything about. That human element, I guess, is the weakest link. Is there a way around that, or is that always going to be the potential Achilles heel in a cyber defense?
Well, it's always going to be. You're obviously not going to take, you know, human weakness out of this. And so you have to design a system that adapts to it, and so that it isn't a catastrophic event if somebody takes a thumb drive from an unclassified computer on the Internet to a classified computer. You want to have processes and you want to prevent that, but you have to assume that in some cases it's still, you know, somebody's going to want to move the photos of their family onto the classified computer. And that will happen even if it's a great violation of policy. So you need a response that's able to deal with those human failures.
One of the concepts that I hear about all the time when I talk to people in government about mobile security is protecting the data rather than the device. And I wonder if we can expect to see more of that just overall, not just in the mobile space, but on government networks in general.
That's certainly something we need to do. And, you know, encryption of data is one of the aspects of defense. Is that, again, it's, you have to assume people are going to break in. If they break in and find encrypted data, it's not impossible to break that encryption, but it takes more and more sophistication. And so you're raising the bar and you're limiting the number of actors who can actually do damage if they do break in.
One part of that I'd like to follow up on when we come back from the break. My guest on Pentagon Solutions today on Federal News Radio 1500. AM is Bill Lynn of DRS Technologies, and we'll continue our conversation on cybersecurity in just a moment on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Life is long and filled with challenges. Navigating these can be difficult, but it doesn't have to be. Hi, this is Lisa Millman from AFMA. For over 133 years, AFMA has been leading military personnel through difficult times to a more secure future with our low-cost life insurance and personal approach. Our policies are available to all members of the armed forces. For a free quote, call 1-877-398-2263 or find us online at AFMA.com today. That's AAFMAA.com.
By combining HP 3PAR utility storage with HP ProLiant Gen 8 servers powered by the latest Intel Xeon processors, you can lower your total cost of ownership and improve project ROI. GovConnection, a federal elite HP partner, can show you how HP can power your data center into the future. Call GovConnection's experienced federal team, where service and commitment to the customer are priority one. Call 800-800-0019 today.
Astrium Services Government Incorporated is the newest name in satellite communications and the only provider of both CompSatCom and MilSatCom systems to the U.S. government. Part of the EADS North America team, Astrium Services Government will soon double X-band and UHF capacity available with the coming launch of two new Skynet satellites. U.S. government customers rely on them for flexible end-to-end SATCOMs using GSA's FCSA contract vehicles. Visit AstriumAmericas.com for more information.
Congratulations on landing the job. I'm really excited for you.
Thanks. How's your search going?
The job market's tight. I mean, I can barely get an interview. Yeah. And I've got student loans to deal with. You're lucky, you know. The National Guard paid your loans off.
Luck? The Guard was a smart decision, one you can still make.
The National Guard Student Loan Repayment Program can pay up to $50,000 of your existing student loans. Get the details at NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the D.C. National Guard, aired by the Maryland, D.C. Delaware Broadcasters Association and this station.
The Washington Wizards are back.
Spins, fades, banks, scores, and one. Okafor.
Up court to Crawford. No look pass. Ariza. Stuff to it.
Crawford drives baseline. Whips it in the corner. Sheldon Mack for three.
Single game tickets are on sale now. Call 202-661-5050. That's 202-661-5050. Or buy your tickets online at WashingtonWizards.com/tickets.
What is national competitiveness? How can the nation better compete in today's global economy? And what are the federal government's long-term cost drivers? Join host Michael Keegan as he explores these questions and the new IBM Setter book, Governing to Win, with guests David Walker and Chuck Prow on a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, Governing to Win series.
Tom Temin here with a preview of Thursday's Federal Drive. Some agencies ranked high in the survey of best places to work, others not so much. We'll talk to the manager at a bottom-ranking office in HUD on why morale and employee engagement can be so helpful. Plus, federal contractors are split on what they think will happen under the grim prospect of the sequester. Those stories and more tomorrow morning starting at 6 on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. And for all the latest federal news, be sure to visit federalnewsradio.com.
Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. My guest on Pentagon Solutions today, former Deputy Secretary of Defense Bill Lynn, now the Chief Executive Officer of DRS Technologies. And before the break, Bill, you said that we have to assume that people will break into our networks. That is a change from the way that government agencies looked at cybersecurity, I think, for a long time. How fast, how easy or hard is it to try to change a mindset like that in government, especially at the Pentagon, and especially when it's something as important as what you, the idea that you're talking about?
Well, I think we need two conceptual breakthroughs, one of which is that we need to treat cyber as a domain of warfare, like land, sea, air, and space. It's critical to our success in all the other four domains. It's much of what gives the U.S. military the advantages it has today in terms of information and command and control. So we need to be able to operate freely in that domain and to protect our assets in that domain, just as we do in any other domain. And that's a conceptual breakthrough. That's a change in our way of thinking. It's something I think that we're adapting to. The institution of the Cyber Command was an organizational reflection of that. I saw Leon Panetta just was at the National Press Club and talked about rules of engagement for cyber. That's another aspect of treating it as a domain of warfare. A second conceptual breakthrough we need is where you were alluding to, is we can't have a Maginot Line mentality. We can't assume, as the French did at the outset of World War I, that we can just build a set of fortifications that are going to be invulnerable to attack. We instead need to have an approach that's more like maneuver warfare. We have to assume the adversary is going to parry and thrust and is going to penetrate in certain areas. We're going to have to respond to those penetrations. We're going to have to bring resources to where the attacks are coming. We are going to suffer breaches. What we have to do is make sure those breaches don't cause damage and they don't break our internal lines of communication.
But that idea that we're going to have to put up with potential attacks and we're going to be penetrated is probably the hardest, in my view, for agencies to deal with, because nobody likes to be the one who is the victim.
No, that's true, Francis. And I probably the biggest reflection I've seen of that when I was in the Pentagon is we started to do exercises in what we called a degraded cyber environment. We'd just say, okay, we're taking away your satellite communications for 12 hours, or we're going to take away this overhead reconnaissance, or you're not going to have access to this information because there's been some sort of cyber compromise. Initial reaction was that, with throwing up your hands, we just can't deal with it. We need this information. It's integral to the way we act, and that's true. And so we do need to be able to assume that we are going to lose pieces of this and parts of this, significant parts. And what are we going to do? What's our mitigation strategy? How do we restore it quickly? But how do we continue to operate while we restore it? And I think that's a change that the military is going through right now.
You talked about the establishing cyber as its own domain. Tell me more about the significance of that, because there was some question about that when that first happened. One of the schools of thought was to do that exact thing. Another school of thought was cyber should be integrated into the already established domains because it's such an integral part of how each of the other domains are defended and in the case of warfighting, how that warfighting is prosecuted. So talk about a little more detail about that and why you believe that cyber should sit on its own as it does right now.
Well, I think you have to treat it as its own domain because it is so central to the other four domains. That through it is how we exercise much of the technological advantage the American military has today. If we lose in the cyber domain, the other domains may not be able to recover in the other domain. So we need to treat it not as subsidiary, as a subpart of some other domain. We need to treat it as a central part of how we operate the military. So that means it ought to be a separate domain and treated as such.
The establishment of Cyber Command was the manifestation of that, as you talked about earlier in the program. There is a conception, fair or not, that Cyber Command oversees military cybersecurity. Homeland Security is responsible for civilian cybersecurity in the federal government. Is the line of delineation, do you think, quite that simple? Is the entire situation quite that simple, or is it more complex than that?
Well, that's an accurate statement of you know, how we've delineated the legal relationships. When you're talking about domestic protection, domestic assets in the U.S., the civil environment, that is the responsibility of Homeland Security. Obviously, protecting national security is the Department of Defense. I think that's, frankly, the correct relationship. The key to making that work, though, is you have to have a relationship between Homeland Security and the Department of Defense. DOD has important assets that it can bring to bear in helping Homeland Security accomplish its mission. Now, that doesn't mean DOD needs to be in the lead. I look at this in some ways, it's a little bit like disaster relief. As we found with Hurricane Sandy, FEMA was in the lead, and FEMA should be in the lead. And that's what you want. And they have the expertise to do this, but they don't have all of the logistics and mobility and other assets that the military does. And it would be a waste of money for them to duplicate the military in that regard. They should rely on the military when they need to. In cyber, I think it's the same. NSA and Cyber Command have enormous cyber capacity and expertise. When Homeland Security needs that to bring to bear in protecting domestic security, they should be able to call on it. And that's the kind of, when I was in office, and it's continued under Secretary Panetta and Secretary Napolitano, that you need to have a strong relationship. We exchanged personnel. We set up agreements as to how we were going to support, not because we needed the agreement to allow the support, but we needed to practice it. We didn't want it to do it the first time when there was a crisis. We needed to know how to support each other.
One of the other parts of that relationship is information sharing. And when we come back from the break, I'd like to talk some about information sharing and how that works in the interagency level. My guest on Pentagon Solutions today is Bill Lynn of DRS Technologies, and we'll continue our conversation in just a moment. You're listening to Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Here's Mike Krieger, Deputy Chief Information Officer, G6, U.S. Army, on the Federal Executive Forum on Defense Cloud Computing, Progress and Best Practices, sponsored by HP.
We really are going to move clouds to the tactical environment. That is going to enable rich situational awareness, role-based access. It's going to enable rich content management and data always available. So you're not going to show up in a new operation with no data when you start, because the data is going to migrate much easier.
To listen to the whole program made possible by the Trezum Media Group, log on to Federal News Radio.
No doubt cloud's promise is appealing. Wary about the return on investments, risks, and governance? Let the experience of HP guide you to cost-effective, secure technology solutions. Cloud solutions can now be purchased by all military services and federal agencies through the Army Private Cloud APC2 contract vehicle. Open up new ways to source, deliver, and govern highly scalable and flexible services. Make cloud a viable option for mission-critical needs through APC2. Visit hp.com/enterprise/gov/APC2.
Every year, someone checks out the safety of your car and tunes it up. Why? Because you want to make sure your friends and family are safe when traveling, and it improves the performance of your car, including its gas mileage. So what about your house? When was the last time you had someone give it a once-over for health and safety issues related to mold, mildew, gas leaks, or carbon monoxide backdrafting from gas-fired appliances? Would you know if you were paying more than you needed to for your energy and water every month? Want to find out? The Local Energy Alliance Program, or LEAP, is a community-based nonprofit that helps homeowners with these issues. LEAP works with local government and utilities to provide residents a one-stop shop of who to call, what to do, and how to pay for it for home energy improvements. LEAP is knowledgeable, trustworthy, and local. Contact LEAP today at ilikeleap.com. That's ilikeleap.com.
This week I've been looking at solar chargers for my iPhone. Last week I was out and about and my iPhone went dead as a doornail. And I thought to myself, you know, there's all this sunlight. Why couldn't I get a solar charger for this? And there are a number of solar chargers out there. Now, the charge time varies anywhere from 6 hours to 12 hours, depending on which one you get. But at least you can get something going.
Stratford University's Tech Talk Radio, Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on 1500 AM.
Diabetes 24/7. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Ira Dreyfuss with HHS HealthBeat. You don't get days off from diabetes. It has to be managed constantly, and not just by monitoring your blood sugar and taking medication appropriately. At the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases, Director Griffin Rogers says a lot of goal setting is involved. He says there are goals about what you can eat and, more importantly, can't, whether you are controlling your weight, and whether you are being physically active.
People with diabetes can't take a vacation from diabetes. They need to make decisions to manage their diabetes 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
People without diabetes can manage, too. Some of those same lifestyle decisions, such as being active and keeping your weight and eating patterns healthy, can help to prevent diabetes. Learn more at healthfinder.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Ira Dreyfuss.
Join FCEA and the U.S. Naval Institute for West 2013, January 29th through 31st in San Diego. Focusing on the strategic shift to the Pacific, this conference and exposition features senior military and government speakers, as well as six panel sessions on budget, fiscal cliff, innovation, retention, cybersecurity, and China. Courses, career, and financial seminars, and Don CIO sessions round out the professional development offerings. Register today at westconfexpo.org.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest on Pentagon Solutions today is Bill Lynn, the Chief Executive Officer of DRS Technologies and the former Deputy Secretary of Defense. We talked about information sharing briefly in the last segment, Bill, and I wonder if you can tell me more about establishing a relationship or building on relationships with the other agencies, in particular, as we talked about the DOD-DHS dynamic, but also with the other agencies with which the various DOD components share information across government.
There's a number of agencies that are critical to the cybersecurity mission. You've mentioned, too, the Department of Defense for the national security mission, protecting the defense networks as well as our overseas efforts. The Department of Homeland Security has the principal responsibility for domestic security. And then, of course, the FBI has the law enforcement function, and it's critical that all three of those agencies work closely together. You need all three perspectives. You need all three agencies' authorities to successfully prosecute this threat.
The information sharing environment, and I'm referring to the broad concept, not the specific office. Mm-hmm. The information sharing environment is getting better. Is it fair to say that there is still room for improvement, that agencies are still improving the process by which they're giving each other information and alerting each other to what they have to share in the first place?
Well, no, I think it is getting better. I actually think the biggest advance we need to make is not between government agencies, but is between the government and the private sector. This is the cybersecurity is an unusual security issue in that it is clear that there are parts of the critical infrastructure that are absolutely essential to our security as a nation, our power network, a transportation network, even our financial networks are very important. But almost all of them, or most of all of them, are in private hands. So that it is essential in protecting our security to have some sort of public-private partnership. And a critical part of that public-private partnership is sharing information about threats, sharing information about responses to threats, and sharing information about advances in technology.
What concerns you about the cyber preparations with the private sector organizations that DOD or DHS, other government entities, would have to share information with?
Well, the challenge, there are many challenges, but one of them is that national security is basically a public good. It may not always be in the financial interests of an individual power company or other part of the critical infrastructure to put the resources into the security that's necessary for the nation's well-being, but it may not meet their needs in terms of a bottom line. So we need to find a sharing, in some cases maybe a sharing of resources, or we need to find ways in which we ensure the pieces of the critical infrastructure that are essential to the economy and the nation's operating are protected appropriately, even if the financial incentives wouldn't necessarily produce that.
Yeah, it's a difficult space because the government certainly can't be in the position of dictating to private companies how they should prepare themselves cyber-wise. And yet, when you talk about critical infrastructure, as we learned again from Hurricane Sandy, someone creating something like the power outages and so forth that we experienced during Hurricane Sandy would be a tremendously terrible situation for us to be in security-wise.
No, that's absolutely right. You don't want the government just to dictate standards broadly across these multiple private sectors. On the other hand, you need to have a certain level of confidence in our ability to protect this. So that's why I use the word partnership. It has to be a public-private partnership. It is not government dictating, but simply the market, free enterprise may not get you the results that you want. So you need some sort of hybrid here, some sort of partnership that produces the right result here.
Now, the department and other federal agencies also share information with academia, with our international partners, and with, of course, with industry that does business with the federal government. What's the role, do you think, of each of those in being able to demonstrate their ability to demonstrate essentially that they're qualified to share the information that the Defense Department and other agencies have? Because it strikes me that we don't want to just give them information without knowing something, having some level of confidence that that information will be equally well protected in their hands as it is in the hands of the federal government.
Well, that's right. And that this is not necessarily a new area with cyber. We have classified information, and when we do share that with industry so that they can build the weapon systems. We share it with academia so they can do research. And we have processes and procedures by which they have to protect that information. Cyber is no different. We would expect that they would have appropriate levels of cyber protection if they're going to use government information that needs to be protected.
Are those standards evolving and changing the same way that the government's own protection against cyber attacks and threats is evolving and changing?
Yeah, this is not as settled an area as protecting, you know, print data, protecting print classified. So it is something that is evolving, and we've been developing standards and processes, and it's moving. It's moving in the right direction, but it's not a mature area yet.
Is the dialogue, in your view, encouraging? I mean, does the private sector understand the gravity of the threat, and do they understand the gravity of the need for them to be — compliance is obviously not the right word — but to be at least on board with some of the wishes and goals of the government and the DOD in particular?
I think the results there are a bit mixed. I was disappointed to see some of the opposition to some of the legislation that's been before Congress. I think it's short-sighted. And so I think a broader view and a longer-term view would suggest that Senator Lieberman and others who've been promoting this legislation are on the right track, that it doesn't need to be as harsh as some of the opponents are suggesting it would be. But we do need some kind of baseline-level protection, and it's not simply going to be produced out of the private sector alone. There has to be this partnership with the private sector has to be taken account in their needs and financial and otherwise. But the government's interest in protecting these critical infrastructure assets has to be taken account of, too.
One thing that all of those stakeholders that I just mentioned, academia, industry, and the government have in common is you're fighting over the same people. And I want to talk about workforce issues when we come back and continue our conversation. My guest is Bill Lynn of DRS Technologies on Pentagon Solutions today on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Back in a moment.
Life is long and filled with challenges. Navigating these can be difficult, but it doesn't have to be. Hi, this is Lisa Millman from AFMA. For over 133 years, AFMA has been leading military personnel through difficult times to a more secure future by offering the right products and services at the right time for the best price. Our low-cost life insurance and personal approach allow us to help you plan wisely and feel comfortable that your family will be taken care of. Our unparalleled survivor assistance services will allow your family to take a deep breath and relax, knowing we'll take care of everything. When you choose AFMA, you choose a partner who will provide guidance, simple solutions, and personalized care. Our life insurance policies are available to all members of the Army, Air Force, Navy, Marine Corps, and Coast Guard. For a free life insurance quote, call a membership coordinator at 1-877-398-2263 or find us online at AFMA.com today. That's AAFMAA.com.
Who are the top leaders in the federal government? Federal News Radio wants to know who has inspired you and what qualities do you think make a great leader? Nominate someone today. A top leader can be someone who knows how to motivate a team to success or a mentor to younger coworkers. A top leader can be anyone. You tell us. Nominations will be accepted through January 8th, and finalists will be announced as part of a Federal News Radio special report in February. Find the nomination form at federalnewsradio.com. Search Top Leaders.
Newsmakers on In Depth with Francis Rose.
Kim Weaver's Director of External Affairs at the Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board.
More and more plan sponsors are offering target date funds, life cycle funds, so that participants who feel undereducated in terms of their asset allocation can simply pick the fund that matches when they think they'll need the money, and they can put their money in and largely forget about it, and we rebalance for them.
Hear the entire interview online, federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Listen each week for Tech Tuesday on Federal News Radio. Every Tuesday, we zero in on how technology inspires innovation. Tuesday mornings at 11, it's Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy, the latest on products that help bring policy to life. Then Tuesday afternoons at 12:30, join Federal News Radio's Jason Miller for Ask the CIO. Hear from the top of the food chain on how your agency is using technology today. Tech Tuesday, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. You're listening to Pentagon Solutions in this hour. My conversation with Bill Lynn, the Chief Executive Officer of DRS Technologies and the former Deputy Secretary of Defense. We talked about cybersecurity and the critical infrastructure needs that companies across the United States have in addition to the federal government. You're essentially competing at a company like the company that you run now for the same kind of talent that other companies and the agencies themselves and academia are all looking for, people who can work in these various specialties. One of the things we chatted about a little bit during the commercial break was cyber as a talent has evolved from one pool to a number of different branches. How does that separation and that specialization affect the strategy that a federal agency or company like yours develops to try to recruit the right people for the right jobs?
Well, you're right, Francis. Getting the right people is critical both for industry and for the government. I think the assumption that the government isn't competitive in the cyber area is probably not right. That actually, I think that although generally the government is not going to be able to pay as well as the private industry, you do find that there's a patriotic element there. There's a level of excitement in working for the government. There's a sense of the importance of the work, and so I've found that particularly in the Department of Defense, National Security Agency, Cyber Command, which are true areas of excellence in cyber and are recognized as such, are very, very competitive in the marketplace. The biggest challenge, frankly, that both industry and the department faces is there's just not enough talent to go around. It's not that they don't compete well for what's there. It's that we need to produce more of it. And that's actually a broader issue and just in the whole science, technology and engineering area. Our nation is coming up a bit short in terms of how much technical talent we produce to be the real engine of the economy.
Do you think the agency has the tools that it needs to be able to keep those people once they get them? I mean, it's one thing to be competitive at attracting them. The retention is the other piece that maybe doesn't get as much attention as it probably should.
I mean, retention is a challenge because the disparity in income grows at the entry level. The disparity in income isn't that large. It's more as you get to senior rank. So you do have some challenges. But my experience has been that we have enormous talent in the cyber arena in the department. And I think the excitement of working in a cutting edge area on these important issues has kept people in cases where sometimes their financial interests would pull them away.
The talent attraction and retention is one part of it. We're starting to see now the various branches of the military establishing career tracks. Mm-hmm. I read the Naval Academy is developing a specialization major in cybersecurity so that officers will come out as cyber specialists ready to lead in those areas. Is that something that you expect to see more of, more specialization, more emphasis, and so on in the next 3 to 5 to 10 years?
I do. You're right about the Naval Academy. I'm actually on a board that oversees the development of that curriculum, the Naval Academy. But they're not alone. The Air Force, the Military Academy at West Point are all promoting cyber as a specialty. We're trying to push it into the National Guard, where you pull on people's civilian expertise so that when they're in uniform, they're drawing on the kinds of cyber expertise they have. So there's an attempt here to be creative to ensure that the nation has in its military the kind of cyber talent it needs to protect their security.
Now, one thing that I've heard from IT leaders around government, not specifically at DOD, but is a level of frustration with new talent coming in, talking about the ability or inability in some cases to use some social media tools and so on. You were pretty influential at DOD at sticking up for the concept that men and women in uniform and civilians should be able to use those collaborative tools in a constructive way. Why was that something that you wanted to put your emphasis on, and what do you think is the result of that policy of more freedom and more openness to use those collaborative tools, especially in that recruiting and retention piece?
Well, when I was in the department, there was, I think, a one track that was going to put our head in the sand and just have an absolute bar on using those kinds of tools, because they do introduce some vulnerabilities. There's no question that there are some vulnerabilities that come out of those tools. But my view was you can't ignore them. They have huge benefits as well as vulnerabilities. So what we needed was a balanced approach where we protected against the vulnerabilities, but we tried to gain the benefit of that social media in not just in the workplace, but in terms of supporting troops overseas. The social media gives an opportunity for a connection between families and deployed troops overseas that really is a game changer in terms of how we maintain that connection. And given what we've been asking our military families to endure over the last decade, anything we can do that supports the connection but to the family back home, we need to do.
How does the cyber landscape impact the ability of making that transition for men and women who maybe have been in a combat role over the past couple of years, want to continue their careers? It seems to me that's a logical opportunity for somebody that either is qualified or demonstrates some of the potential to be qualified to move to transition into those areas, especially in the uniform side.
Well, we've certainly been trying to promote that, and in terms of, I say we, I'm no longer in the department, but the department has certainly been trying to promote that and to train people while they're in uniform to develop skills that they can use out in the civilian workforce, and then, as I say, maybe contribute back as members of the Guard and Reserve. So it's a multifaceted approach.
We just have a few minutes left. When we come back from the break, I'd like to maybe get a little personal and talk about some of your personal experiences inside the agency and what you're doing now. My guest is Bill Lynn. He's the Chief Executive Officer of DRS Technologies, the former Deputy Secretary of Defense, and we'll wrap up our conversation in just a moment.
If you raise high the buff in blue, now's your chance to win prizes for showing your commitment to the Colonials. Visit RaiseHighRewards.com now and start earning points for your likes, retweets, shares, check-ins, and more with GW Athletics content from GWSports.com and social media properties. Registration is free, and you can win special fan experiences, ticket upgrades, and buff in blue gear. Visit RaiseHighRewards.com now.
I'm on a mission to spread the word about COPD through music. COPD stands for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. My grandfather suffered from symptoms of it, and COPD is the fourth leading cause of death in the U.S. I'm Billy Ray Cyrus, and I drive for COPD. Looks like people are starting to get the message. Anyone age 35 and older who has smoked as little as 100 cigarettes could be at risk. Visit driveforcopd.com today and talk to your doctor.
The year was 1933, and a 23-year-old engineer named Kelly Johnson was feeling the heat. His bosses at Lockheed Aircraft were betting the future of the company on a new plane, the first to be outfitted with twin engines. What was keeping Johnson up at night was his concern about the stability of the design and what to do about it. Now, after 70 tests in a wind tunnel, he had the answer. Something no one had tried before. Kelly Johnson's twin tail concept for the Model 10 Electra not only stabilized the plane, but also helped usher in a new era in aviation technology. In less than a decade, A Model 12 was flying missions over North Africa, and a Model 14 had flown around the world in record time. The all-metal twin-engine Electra was flying high, and so was Lockheed Aircraft. The Electra story is our story. See it unfold at LockheedMartin.com/100years.
If you are facing advanced illness or the end of life of a loved one, peace of mind is in short supply. Fortunately, pain-free comfort care is available from the Washington Home and Community Hospices, a not-for-profit organization with a holistic team of doctors, nurses, caregivers, social workers, chaplains, and volunteers. The team comes to you in your home or wherever you call home in D.C., Montgomery, or Prince George's County. For your peace of mind, call them day or night for a complimentary consultation at 866-234-7222.
Hi, this is Odonna Matthews. What does three decades of service add up to? For the Capital Area Food Bank, it includes these important numbers. Distributing 25 million pounds of food to nearly 500,000 people through a network of 700 partner agencies. 30 years, it's a long time. But the mission continues to make sure that no one is left hungry. To learn more, contribute, or volunteer, visit CapitalAreaFoodBank.org.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest for the hour on Pentagon Solutions today, the former Deputy Secretary of Defense Bill Lynn. In studio with me for the hour now, the Chief Executive Officer at DRS Technologies. Bill, when you left the Pentagon a little bit less than a year ago, the chatter in classes seemed to think that you were most likely to land at one of the top five, and we all know who they are. You instead are at DRS Technologies. What's appealing to you? What was appealing to you about what they do and how they serve the federal business community?
Well, I'd seen DRS both as a customer from the department and as a competitor when I was at Raytheon in between government service, and I was really impressed with the people and the technology and the culture of excellence that's at DRS. So I was very interested in DRS when Finmeccanica approached me. Finmeccanica, a European defense company, actually owns DRS, and so it's actually a larger defense enterprise than you'd think. Finmeccanica is one of the top 10 defense companies in the world. So it gave me an opportunity to have a strong operational role while working for one of the giants in the defense industry. And as we go forward, Finmeccanica is going to give me an opportunity in the coming weeks where I'll oversee all of their defense operations in the United States. So it was a real opportunity, and I was very honored to be offered it.
Let me talk on a personal level also. Tell me what was different about the Pentagon when you left as controller and then came back in 2009 and then when you left as the Deputy Secretary of Defense. What's changed maybe culturally, or what did you see working differently for better or for worse either way at those various mileposts in your tenure there?
Well, in both instances, the quality of people in both the civilian and military ranks in the Department of Defense, it just continues to astound me. Just the quality in terms of the talent and the quality in terms of their commitment to the nation's security. So that was a constant. The biggest difference, I would say, is going into the Pentagon in 2009, we were a nation at war, whereas we were not in the 1990s, and that changed a lot of things in terms of, you know, how important it was to it's always important to get it right, but really important when you have men and women fighting in overseas locations. So that was the biggest difference.
We've talked extensively about cybersecurity. Did you ask for that portfolio from Secretary Gates, or were you given that when you got there? Because with your background as a controller, that's not something that I would think off the top of my head that would be a natural for you.
Well, you know, the deputy kind of tends to get the things that fall between the stools. And when I first got to the department, I had thought cybersecurity was an important issue and something that we needed to work on. And I asked for memos from the various parts of the agency that had some responsibility for cybersecurity about what they thought we ought to be doing and where we thought we ought to go. And what I got was fairly mild, except the major paragraph in each of these memos was they ought to, that their part of the agency ought to be in charge of this issue, which let me know that nobody was in charge of this issue. And that's generally where the deputy works in. And so I tried to help pull things together as we developed cyber policy in the department.
One of the areas that agencies are talking about a lot when it comes to cyber is innovation. They want to see more innovation. Industry is sometimes confused, shall we say, about what the, what innovation means to the various agencies. You were talking about this issue at the Naval Institute Forum last week. What's industry's role in presenting innovation to the government agencies, DOD in particular, but trying to avoid the shiny object syndrome of this, you should get this because it's cool, not because it necessarily solves a problem that you have?
Well, the central point I was trying to make at the Naval Institute Forum, the speech you're referring to, was that we're in a period now where the defense budget is either going to be stagnant or decline. And that's probably going to last a number of years. And in those kinds of periods, that's when it's most important to focus on innovation. It's most important that we protect the technologies, whether it's unmanned aerial vehicles or cyber, what we've been talking about today, that we protect those technologies because that's what's going to win the conflicts of the future.
We were laughing during the last commercial break that I have a whole stack of questions here and not nearly enough time to ask them all. So I have enjoyed this conversation. Would love to have you come back and continue it at some point.
I'd love to come back.
Thank you very much for your time today, sir. I appreciate it. Bill Lynn is the Chief Executive Officer of DRS Technologies, the former Deputy Secretary of Defense. This conversation will be archived later this afternoon at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. And hour number two of In Depth with Francis Rose coming in a moment on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.